Welcome to Box Office Battles, where we take bombs, forgotten hits, and something else.
The other one.
Yeah, the other one. And we pit them together for a battle. A battle royale to be placed in the fucking halls of all hall. Damn this beer, dude. Sorry.
That's how you know it's working.
That's right. The IPA is doing what it's supposed to do.
Listen, basically, you're literally going to beat me with one mental hand tied behind your back.
I'm the judge, so.
Oh, that's right. Brandon's going to beat me.
I'm Biggs.
I'm Zach.
And I'm the beard.
Who's going to beat the shit out of me?
Okay, Brandon, why don't you start off here?
All right. In this corner, we're going to have Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
And in my corner, we have legendary football comedy, The Replacements.
Legendary?
To me, sure.
Okay.
I've written a legend about it.
All right, Brandon, why don't you tell us what it's all about?
We were near Barstow on the edge of the desert when the drugs began to take hold. Rolling down the desert in a mid-60s red Cadillac with bat-like creatures swooping all around. We had 2 bags of grass, 75 pellets of mescaline, 5 sheets of high-powered blotter acid, a salt shaker half full of cocaine, a whole galaxy of multicolored uppers, downers, screamers, laughers, and also a quart of tequila, a quart of rum, a case of Budweiser, a pint of raw ether, and 2 dozen amyls. Not that we needed all that for the trip. But once you get locked into a serious drug collection, the tendency is to push it as far as you can. The heroes pick up a hitchhiker. Spider-Man Tobey fucking Maguire.
Right away. Great cameo for somebody who wasn't even famous.
Hey, he was part of Leo's Pussy Pack.
Was that 99?
We can get into the Pussy Pack later.
On assignment to cover the Mint 400 for Rolling Stone magazine, they round up materials for the trip and end up doing mescaline on the beach. Dropping acid as your tourney, I suggest you try drive top speed. It'll be a goddamn miracle if you get there turning into a wild fucking animal. They check into the hotel and saunter up to the bar. People transform into reptiles. A wild reptile orgy. A night in the hotel room with the appearance of Craig Bierko, the photographer for the Mint 400. Cut to the next morning, the start of the Mint 400. In some circles, the Mint 400 is far, far better thing than the Super Bowl, the Kentucky Derby, and the Lower Oakland Roller Derby Finals all rolled into one. The race of trucks, special breed. The race was all definitely underway. I had witnessed the start. But what next? Traveling down the strip, down to the Tropicana, to see Debbie Reynolds. They wander into a fucking time capsule. Moments later, forcibly removed, and onto the circus. A few quick hits of ether. Ah, the devil ether. It makes you behave like the village drunkard in some early Irish novel. Total loss of all basic motor function. Blurred vision, no balance, numb tongue. The mind recoils in horror, unable to communicate with the spinal column. Which is interesting because you can actually watch yourself behave in this terrible way, but you can't control it. On through the circus with appearance by Vern Troyer and Penn of Penn and Teller.
And Vern Troyer, once again, not famous yet.
Some would argue Vern Troyer isn't famous now either. He had a little peek in there.
Do you think the Love Guru did that?
It didn't help.
No. Or pissing on a bed on that reality show.
But I would argue that when you say Mini-Me, everybody knows who you're talking about.
Oh, definitely. But if you said, who is Mini-Me?
Yeah, that's where it gets a little hazy.
This town is not a good town for psychedelic drugs. As the attorney is having a fight with a grapefruit using a Bowie knife, the attorney recalls an incident in the elevator. Another cameo of Cameron Diaz.
Now, who's playing the attorney and who's playing the main character here?
The main character is Johnny Depp. The attorney is Benicio del Toro.
Okay.
After a stroll through the casino downstairs, Hunter comes back to Benicio del Toro in the tub listening to Jefferson Airplane, where the attorney demands that Duke throw the recorder into the tub when White Rabbit peaks.
Hunter is Duke, by the way.
Soon, one of the best scenes comes with the following monologue. Strange memories of the nervous night in Las Vegas. Years later, 6, it seems like a lifetime, or at least a main era. The kind of peak that never comes again. San Francisco in the middle 60s was a very special time and place to be part of.
Can I play the clip for that?
Absolutely.
I'm sorry, dude. I know I'm stepping out here, but...
This is about as biased as a judge can get. Oh, can I play the clip I have ready for your movie?
I never said I had it ready. I'm sorry, dude. That is something that should be heard, though.
Oh, definitely.
Understand.
No, 100%. I'd have done the same. I just felt the need to give shit. I'm lashing. I'm like a creature that's being hunted. I'm just lashing out at anything that comes near me. I know the end is near, and I'm trying to fight to stay alive.
Strange memories on this nervous night in Las Vegas. Has it been 5 years? 6? It seems like a lifetime. The kind of peak that never comes again. San Francisco in the middle 60s was a very special time and place to be a part of. But no explanation, no mix of words or music or memories can touch that sense of knowing that you were there and alive in that corner of time in the world. Whatever it meant. There was madness in any direction, at any hour. You could strike sparks anywhere. There was
no
universal sense that whatever we were doing was right.
Rendering.
That we were winning. And that, I think, was the handle. That sense of inevitable victory over the forces of old and evil. Not in any mean or military sense. We didn't need that. Our energy would simply prevail. We had all the momentum. We were riding the crest of a high and beautiful wave. So now, less than 5 years later, you can go up on a steep hill in Las Vegas and look west. And with the right kind of eyes, you can almost see the high water mark. That place where the wave finally broke and rolled back.
Man, you got so lucky an ad didn't pop up at the beginning of that.
No shit.
The decision to flee had come suddenly. Johnny Depp hightails it, leaves town, only to get pulled over by a highway traffic cop. Few people understand the psychology of dealing with a highway traffic cop. A normal speeder will panic and immediately pull over to the side. This is wrong. It arouses contempt in the cop's heart. Make the bastard chase you. He will follow. But he won't know what to think of your blinker signal that are you right, about to turn right. This is to let you know that you're pulling off for a proper place to start. To top. It will take him a moment to realize he's about to make a 180 degree turn at speed. But you know, he will be ready for it. Brace for the G's, fast heel toe work. A quick smooch within the desert with Gary Busey, and suddenly Duke was checked into the Flamingo Hotel by Spence, played by Killer Keller. The room is already occupied by the attorney on acid with Lucy, played by Christina Ricci. She's an artist from Kalispell, Montana, who paints portraits of Barbara Streisand.
That's a very specific skill. Yeah.
There can't be a big niche for selling portraits of Barbara Streisand. Well, actually, I guess Barbara Streisand does have a lot of money. You just got it.
I did. Damn, my PA.
What soon follows is a quick lecture on the dangers of marijuana, followed by an advisory to take a little hit of the little brown bottle in the shaving kit. It's at this point the film takes a dark tone, a dark, drug-fueled, psychotic rampage across the streets of Las Vegas. It was all over now. We'd abused every rule that Vegas lived by, burning the locals, abusing the tourists, terrifying the help. The only chance now I felt was the possibility we've gone to such excess that nobody in the position could bring the hammer down on us could possibly believe it. Duke rushes the attorney to the airport with the final monologue before rushing off in the white Cadillac. We are now wired into survival trip now. No more was the speed that fueled the 60s. That was a fatal flaw in Tim Leary's trip. He crashed around America, selling a consciousness expansion without ever giving a thought to the grim meat hooker realities that we were lying in wait for all the people who took him seriously. All those pathetic, eager acid freaks who thought that they could buy peace and understanding for $3 a hit. But their loss and failure was ours too. What Leary took down with him was the whole central illusion of a lifestyle that he helped create, a generation of permanent cripples, failed seekers who never understood the essential old mystic fallacy of the acid culture, the desperate assumption that somebody, or at least some force, is tending the light at the end of the tunnel. The film ends with Raul Duke rolling down a desert highway with Viva Las Vegas playing in the background.
Is it just me, or did those cars add like a weird
They really they did,
like,
yeah.
Like we did this on purpose. All right, go ahead, Zach. If you need me to cue up a clip, you just tell me.
That'd be great, thanks. So we're going to talk about The Replacements, which follows Keanu Reeves as Shane Footsteps Falco, a former Ohio State quarterback who is definitely not Johnny Utah, unless you read my copious pages of Replacements fan fiction. In which case, he's on a special mission from the president to find out why the commissioner of the NFL is trying to cover up concussions. We learn he was a talented prospect, but he had an inability to handle pressure, and it submarined his entire career, and he lost the Sugar Bowl. He's eventually recruited by Coach
G. I got a quick question.
Hit me.
When you said lost the Sugar Bowl, was this a dinner time thing, or was this like an actual game?
Well, as some listeners may not be familiar, the college football championship is a series of bowl games, none of which are in a playoff structure. They just all sort of happen.
Like the Tostitos Bowl?
Much like the Tostitos Fiesta Bowl.
Oh, that's right.
And the Orange Bowl and the Rose Bowl and the National Championship Bowl.
What are they called?
The Orange Bowl.
I think it's like the Cheetos Orange Bowl.
Yeah, and there's a whole bunch of bowls, and he lost the Sugar Bowl.
The Tampax Rose Bowl. So, the Jergens. The Jergens Super Bowl. That's all I got.
So we open on him. He's working cleaning barnacles off the bottom of boats. And there's a great song that's 90s pop rock music that's scoring this. I believe it's Lit. Yeah, it's Lit. It's Ziploc. That's the song. And he's going down cleaning barnacles off boats, and he finds his old All-American trophy, and he uses it to begin playing underwater alone time football. We then cut to the Washington Sentinels.
What's the name of that song again?
Ziploc by Lit.
All right.
And thank you. And we watch the Washington Sentinels. We hear John Madden and Pat Summerall tell us about the player strike that's starting as soon as the game ends. Or for these players, as soon as the game ends. Other teams have already started. And we watch their shitty quarterback, Eddie Martell, take a slide to avoid getting hurt instead of going for a touchdown to win the game. In a scene that is retroactively hilarious, knowing everything we know about ligament injuries and concussions, that they're like, what a pussy, trying not to get lit the fuck up. But all the players are walking out, and including the coaches, and they have to get, if they want to play, they have to get replacement players who are willing to walk the picket line. So they hire Coach Gene Hackman, which I think a lot of people would agree, Coach is the best brand of Gene Hackman. Anytime Gene Hackman's coaching somebody, I'm in. And he recruits a team of players he had his eye on back when he was coaching full-time and professionally. And Footsteps Falco is among them. And I'm just going to run down the list of some of the players he recruits, because as I'm sure you'd be shocked to imagine.
I didn't luck out with the ad.
You weren't going to get lucky twice in a row. As I'm sure you'd be hard pressed to believe, in a movie, in a comedy like this, he gets a cast of kooky characters together.
Whoa.
I know. So we've got Nigel Gruff. Yeah. I actually legitimately like this song, and I'm not sure.
I still enjoy this song.
I'm not sure if I like the song because of the movie or just because I like the song.
Oh, there's a little bit of dialogue in
this
song.
Ooh, this is the classic music video with a story.
You are a disgusting slob.
Is that Dee Snider? I'm not used to him seeing him without all the lipstick.
I know, right?
Your uniform. What kind of a man are you? You're worthless and weak. You sit in here all day and play that sick, repulsive, electric twanger. Who are you?
Where I'm sorry, dude. This review went off the rails.
That's okay. I'm actually sort of captivated by this plot.
What do you do with your life?
I want to rock.
All right, I'm just going to talk while this great song plays.
That's definitely Dee Snider.
Oh, it's 100% Dee Snider.
Yeah.
So we've got Nigel Gruff as played by future Lizard Resi fans. He's a Welsh former soccer player and he owns a bar. He smokes anytime he goes out to kick and he loses all his money to gambling all the time. We have Walter Cochran, who is a former talented running back who is now in the seminary and has devoted his life to God. We've got Earl Wilkinson, a.k.a. Ray Smith, who is a felon who is paroled. He was serving for assaulting a police officer, and he's paroled by permission of the governor of Maryland to play for the team. We have Danny Bateman as played by future Iron Man director Jon Favreau, and he's basically if Wolverine played football. Like, he's just all rage and stupidity. We've got Jumbo Famico, who's a sumo wrestler now playing offensive tackle. We have the Jackson brothers, who are former talented offensive linemen whose NFL careers fell apart because they cannot play on separate teams.
I thought you were gonna say guitarist and singer of the Jackson 5. That I was like, too. It's Jermaine and Michael.
Well, they do end up in music related careers as the bodyguards for Old Dirty Bastard. Wu-Tang 2 episodes in a row. We have Clifford Franklin, who's a stock boy slash clerk at a little thrift store, who's fast as shit but cannot catch anything, as illustrated by him chasing someone who steals a Twinkie from the store. The thief throws the Twinkie in the air, and he cannot get a fucking Twinkie out of the sky. We also have cheerleaders, who are made up primarily of the head cheerleader of the Sentinels and a shitload of strippers. And we get occasional meetings from the old Sentinels players who are just straight-up douchebags. So I'm not going to go too much into the plot because anybody who's seen a sports movie, especially a sports comedy, knows how this is going. They're going to lose for a while, come together as a team, win some games, lose again for heartbreak, and then win the final game in the movie. I mean, that's all. You know it's coming a mile away.
That is the formula.
Of course, yeah. I don't know how you go on a losing streak and still win a championship.
Well, they don't. They don't win the championship. They win the last game in the movie, which is just the game that gets them into the playoffs. Because then the strike ended.
Well, then it's like the Cowboys playoff run.
Exactly. So we follow this band of misfits as they have their wacky hijinks, mostly football related, like puking in the huddle, the deaf tight end who's easily the best football player on the team not being able to communicate with them. They have a bar fight that culminates with them in a jail cell singing and dancing to I Will Survive, which is a pretty magical scene. We have them all coming together and we learn a fundamental lesson about how glory will last forever.
Now, does it last forever?
I mean, it's implied. We don't see forever throughout the film, but it is implied that glory will last forever.
People still remember the Immaculate Reception.
That's right, and I remember the Replacements.
Which team?
Or the catch. Tell me you don't remember the catch.
I mean, I remember it from rewatching it on TV, but I was pretty young when the catch happened. All right, so here's my first question. What is the team that they play for?
The Washington Sentinels. Not real.
Yeah.
Not a team. They could not get the NFL license for probably good reasons on the NFL's behalf.
Fair enough.
Yes. I'm gonna rack up some points. I still think I got a shot at winning this.
Despite being a box office bust, this movie was selected for the Criterion Collection.
I agree. It 100% should be a Criterion Collection. But the Criterion Collection is also pretentious and doesn't understand the value. Much like Doritos at 1 in the morning when you're drunk, there's value to something light but lovable. We get to see a lot of things in this film, but something that always sticks out to me is the thing that's most special to me about sports, about playing them when I was younger and playing them now, is the camaraderie that builds between a group of people on a team together. And there's a lot of great sports movies, but very few can illustrate the coming together of a team as well as this one. They come from such disparate backgrounds, they have no real reason to like each other. But when you get someone with a true vision, like Gene Hackman, who is not playing a character, he's just Gene. Okay, he is. He's playing Jimmy McGinty. But for my purposes, he's just Gene Hackman.
Is that
Hackman.
The character in Hoosiers?
No, Jimmy McGinty's his character in this. Well, he's not
you
playing.
You almost had an extra point there.
What we learned is that under true vision and when everyone buys into one thing, even people who should be enemies can come together for a greater goal and achieve something that no one man can achieve alone.
While I agree with you, for the most part, the Criterion Collection is pretentious. This is the one part, to even quote yourself, where the Criterion Collection goes with quality and pretentiousness both in the same direction.
I regret saying that before we recorded. Should have saved that for after.
I got to interject as judge. I believe that what he actually said was where it's pretentious coolness and cool meet.
Yep. Which I stand by. I 100% stand by that.
All right. While putting together a list of quality, quirky characters, it is still in the same genre where everybody puts together their own foot into the door and makes for a fun time. But you know what's happening. It's really just a series of tropes in the entire movie.
See, I tuned out after everything after quirky characters, because if you want quirky characters, this is the place to come. The Replacements, my friends. It doesn't get much quirkier than this. I mean, you've got big, funny, fat guys who do awesome dances when they score touchdowns. You've got strippers whose primary job is to arouse the other team so they stop paying attention. It doesn't get much quirkier than that. Again, they do a dance synchronized with no music in jail.
I do got to interject really quick before we continue with the argument so you can think about this, Brandon, on your counterpoint. But there's this movie called The Cheerleaders, mm-hmm. where the cheerleaders wind up fucking out their own team. So then they go on a mission the next night to fuck out the other team. And then both teams, like, they literally line up at the line of scrimmage and just fall over like they're incapable of doing
good
anything.
God. What the fuck were they doing at night that they can't even stand up?
I mean, it's a Roger Corman flick. I don't know what to tell you.
All I'm saying is that's
it's by director Jack Hill. That gives you any clue.
That is some heavy duty fucking is all I'm saying.
And if you want to hear some other Jack Hill films, we literally talk on Real Roulette about which one was it?
Oh, it's
Big Birdcage,
yeah.
Which is a Jack Hill film where they want to fuck out the prison guards. They want to badly. Seems to be a common theme in Jack Hill. Anyway, I'm sorry, Brian. Go ahead and make your point.
Oh, wait. Isn't it my turn to make a point?
You ended. It's
Brian's. Didn't I do a counterpoint?
That was a counterpoint.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. Come on, man. At least try to be partial.
I'm giving you the bell.
As I've said many a time throughout this, I'm fighting an uphill battle. So I'm just going to try to appeal to base instincts. Pretty colors and lots of fast moving parts. Sports movies are great for that. Bright jersey colors on that beautiful green field. Roided out hulks, freaks of men just destroying each other and trying to give each other long-term health issues. I mean, if there's a symphony of violence more beautiful than that, I don't think I've seen it.
That's a pretty good point.
Hunter S. Thompson's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas has lots of violence and pretty color. It takes place in Vegas, of all places. There is no place shinier on the planet. You could actually see Vegas from space. It's so shiny.
That sounds pretty shiny.
All right, my final point. The cameos in this, I've left out the two best for last. The first one is, you were talking about hulked out players. One that actually met the Hulk, Harry Dean Stanton, plays a judge.
Oh, that's a good point, dude. Oh. I'm sorry, go ahead. What's the other one?
The other one is a cameo by none other than himself, Hunter S. Thompson, as himself.
You're going to be the last man Stanton tonight.
I enjoyed that pun. You get an extra point.
Hey, thanks. Now I've only lost by 39 instead of 40.
They kicked the field goal.
I'm going to eschew my counterpoint and just make one final point because I know he doesn't get to come back at this one. I'm going to talk directly at you, Biggs. Today, you need to make a choice as a father, as a son, and as a man. What's more important to you? Drugs or glory? What is more fulfilling? What is more powerful? You tell me.
Okay, I will say directly back to you, Zach, that you are correct. If I was to watch a movie with my wife today, it would be The Replacements because she hates Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. It was such a depressing... Wait.
Can we call your wife at work and get a bonus judge in here real quick?
Because it was one of the most depressing moments of my life when I watched that with her and realized that she could give a fuck less. And then when I tried to explain the subtext about the time period it took place and what it all means, like, dude, she just wanted the movie to be over with. That being said, I love this movie. I love the book. It's my all-time favorite book. The movies and... gotta be in my top 10 movies of all time. You knew you were fighting an uphill battle and you lost. We already established I'm the judge that if I see both movies, I'm gonna go with the one I like best. I don't care how well the argument is. That being said, you did a really good argument. You're to be commended for it. But forgotten ultimately.
Not by me.
All right, so I would give Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, it's an excellent plus. It just is, dude. There are so many layers to this film. It's fun on like a kooky level. It's fun if you know the politics going on. The acting is grade A. They picked the perfect music for it. The visuals are great. Like, it is Terry Gilliam's crowning achievement as far as I'm concerned. The Replacements is actually pretty enjoyable. Like, I will stick up for it. I've not gone and rewatched it, but I remember liking it a lot through a drunken haze.
Which is the way to watch it.
Which I believe was also in the early 2000s. So I'm probably going to go like an S plus on that one.
Yeah.
I think I'm in total agreement. I remember as you were talking, it brought back the kicker.
Yeah.
Like with the cigarette hanging out of his mouth. Like up to his eyeball, like with like loan sharks around him. Like.
And he's wiry.
And once again, guys, like just because something's forgotten doesn't mean it wasn't a great movie.
That's right.
Sometimes we have to make hard decisions.
Exactly. Sometimes
show.
When you pit two giants up against each other.
Especially when we don't talk to each other about what the movie's going to be in advance because you just get pariahs sometimes. You get the one movie that everybody knows is going to win no matter what. So it's Army of Darkness is the same one.
Yep.
I went against that and I was like, well, I'm fucked. I'm not going to really argue that hard against Army of Darkness. The same. I'm glad you took the bullet on this one, Zach. I was about to argue against it, and it would have been
pathetic. I saved you a loss on your
thank
record.
You for that. Anyway, so what are you guys' grades here?
A solid satisfactory on The Replacements. It was a fun watch. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed it. The characters were entertaining. As far as Fear and Loathing, an excellent plus. I mean, that one of my all-time favorite movies.
I have the exact same grades as you, Biggs. I've got S plus for Replacements and E plus for Fear and Loathing.
That's always hard when you're fighting now, a movie you know is better.
Oh, yeah. And here's what I will say for Replacements, though. This is the one thing where it wins, because it doesn't really win as a quality movie. It doesn't win as anything with any real meaning. However, if I'm going to watch one random movie and sort of let myself fall asleep, I'm going to choose Replacements every time. I've been watching that movie all the time since I was a kid, and it's just like comfort food to me.
So you heard it here first, Replacements, a natural replacement for
only if you no. Aid. That it only becomes that way if you're willing to sit through it 30 or 40 times first, because it doesn't just start as a sleeping aid.
All right, so fill those seats, and so we don't have to.
Jack the Ripper, middle name T, I guess you could take it like that. Jack T. Ripper.
Yeah, if his middle name is The.
Yeah.
At least in his title, that would be the middle initial. So Jack T. Ripper.
T. Ripper. Jack Tripper from Three's Company.
Done and done, dude.
It's over.
That's unfucking believable. You solved the mystery.
Dude, give me my fucking money.
Yeah, no, I agree. Give him his fucking prize
for that, because I put that shit together.
Folks, it's real. Recognize.
Yeah, John Ritter, woman murderer.
Yeah. dead now cannot be brought to justice.
Dude, nobody's ever gonna know the truth.
Real Roulette with Zach and Biggs.
She covers her body with chicken fat, completely strips naked. Down.
Yep.
Goes running through the camp, and every girl tries to stop her.
But they can't.
But they can't because it's chicken fat.
She slips through them. No, it has been established she's been trying to get at the other black girl.
It doesn't even look like they're even touching
no,
her. Like, it's the worst acting ever.
No. I just like to imagine that she's the Barry Sanders of this prison camp. Like, when she turns it on, ain't nobody can stop her.
Shooting the shit show.
Who would win between Heisenberg and Godzilla? I came to the conclusion that Heisenberg would poison him with rice, and Joe was saying he'd find a way to chemically alter something in the sea and dissolve him or something.
There are two very unknown chemicals that, when combined, react to dissolve kaiju monsters.
Box office battle.
Would you say that the Necronomicon is a MacGuffin of sorts?
No, this is a single book, bound in few and flesh, inked in blood.
Brandon, are you familiar with what a MacGuffin is?
I have no idea.
It's essentially an object, a person, or a place that doesn't really matter, but it's a put in place to drive the plot forward. Because see, I appreciate a film that knows how to use its literary device as well.
It is a literal literary device.
Montucky Sky.
What if we get Fassbender as like the sadistic ruler of this dystopian future?
Yes.
We have the already sick and twisted Fassbender as the king, and he's getting whispers from someone even more sadistic and Willem Dafoe.
Jesus is Robocop. This is no longer the driving force of this movie.
Uh-huh.
Not safe for network.